Welcome to the Healthy Skin Show with Jennifer Fugo, where we're flipping everything you've been told about your chronic skin issues upside down and connecting you with alternative solutions your dermatologist never told you about.
Welcome back to episode number 300 of the Healthy Skin Show. And I have to take a moment to acknowledge that we finally hit the 300 episode milestone after hitting over 1 million total downloads of the show a few months ago. And while it's certainly been a ton of work, I couldn't have done it without my amazing team that helps keep things rolling, as well as you. So thank you just as much for being on this crazy journey with me that is the Healthy Skin Show. Now, if you saw the title of this episode and were a bit taken aback, thinking, wait, research isn't always right? We're gonna dive into this today, because the truth is that research that looks promising in a research setting doesn't always work in the body, specifically your body. So if you've ever stumbled across some amazing study about some supplement or nutrient or diet that yielded what looked like great results, and you're left feeling like you found some super secret key, thinking to yourself, why is no one talking about this? Then you know exactly what I'm talking about. Amazing research that maybe even makes you consider or question if it could possibly rival the power of a medication. While I think these types of research outcomes are certainly interesting, I have learned over the years to practice restraint with my enthusiasm. The reason is that clinical experience working directly with clients has taught me that what might work in a controlled setting may not work so well in a much larger and more diverse population. And on the flip side, I've also seen where certain combinations of products or alternative interventions work well together, but no studies yet exist and probably never will, to demonstrate efficacy on a grander, broader scale so that it would be accepted by conventional medicine. So the point here is that research isn't perfect. And if we're going to be honest, it should be stated that what we know and understand about the human body, as with so many other things in life, is probably a drop in the proverbial bucket. And this was impressed upon me over the years by my father. And for those of you who may or may not know, he was an MD, so a medical doctor, a PhD, a surgeon, and an avid researcher who constantly was inventing crazy technologies for which he held many patents before his death in 2020. I used to get so excited about studies that showed a certain nutrient at a specific dose, for example, that could help with some sort of specific health issue. But with time and then implementing research in clients who are all in their own right very different, I discovered that the research doesn't always work the way the studies suggest. And this explains why there is no one protocol for fixing specific issues. I'm always asked for that. What's the protocol for eczema or dyshidratic eczema or plaque psoriasis? There is no one protocol. It's because everyone is so different. And it underscores why research paired with clinical experience is probably a more valuable combination when it comes to solving health struggles. I'm not saying that research isn't true or not to be trusted, but it continues to evolve and must be taken with a grain of salt. And that's why I get frustrated seeing research outcomes overstated by both practitioners and those online sharing about their latest research find in patient support forums like on Facebook. And it's worth highlighting both sides of the coin here, since it will directly impact the information you might end up consuming. And I see this happen at conferences that I have attended, where practitioners, including physicians who are MDs, are definitely open-minded, but they present research on topics that seem very promising, and yet there are questions that I have about why we're presenting information that we don't really know what the clinical application is. And recently I sat in on a talk at a medical conference about different probiotic strains used to treat eczema. And all of the research that was shared sounded great, except for a few issues that I had. So first, the studies were very small, most of them having under 50 or even 20 participants. The second issue was that the presenting physician likely doesn't practice in a fully integrative manner. So I'm rather skeptical if this research has actually been tested out in his patient population. At no point was it ever mentioned that they had experience putting this promising research to the test on actual eczema patients. And thirdly, what adds to my concern is that as someone who has actively used many different probiotic strains and probiotic combination formulas in my clinical experience, I haven't really seen this type of substantial improvement that they're saying in the studies show up in practice. So there's a disconnect there when you're presenting this to a group of other doctors and practitioners being like, oh, look, if you do this, this could possibly happen. But not knowing when you present that data that it actually doesn't work that way. Now, it doesn't mean that I don't believe in the power of probiotics. I just want to say that because I certainly do. And I'm not highlighting this story for that particular reason. But there are so many more factors that could prevent the probiotics themselves from working the way that the research has stated. And this is where the clinical application of research is so important. And I only know this because I actually work with clients. And that information gets lost in the weeds when a practitioner doesn't try out the interventions first, or maybe they've retired and never really had a chance to actually try them out with their patients, or is no longer seeing patients or clients, thus they're really not up to date on the current clinical interventions and how they work in practice because their career has shifted away from a clinical setting. And I'll share a behind-the-scenes story with you quickly that underscores exactly what I'm talking about. A few months ago, I interviewed Dr. Sean Quatra for an upcoming episode about prurigo nodularis, which will be released in 2 or 3 weeks from now. This is a truly hellish, itchy condition that hasn't had many great options for treatment. Now, before the interview, my associate and I pulled a bunch of interesting small studies using different topical skin preparations from natural ingredients that showed positive outcomes to reduce itchiness. So before we started recording, I asked Dr. Quatra if we could dive into these studies and talk about them and detail some of these alternative options. And he chuckled and very kindly told me that he has clinically never seen much improvement or relief in patients trying these more natural preparations. I was really bummed to hear this, but it underscores what I'm talking about here, that research may not pan out the way we'd hope in a clinical setting. And this is all beside many other issues with studies and how they are conducted, which also can cloud the outcomes or make them rather questionable. Some of you might recall episode 95 of the Healthy Skin Show podcast, where I detailed a study about the use of a single amino acid, specifically L-histidine, to improve eczema. I've seen this paper presented at several conferences pointing to how incredible this simple intervention that had such a similar impact on eczema rashes compared to a, and I quote, mid-potency steroid. While it's certainly neat, I did offer a dose of reality in the podcast episode that I often don't hear in these presentations. So first of all, the study was only done on 24 people. That's small. Secondly, and probably more importantly, I've not witnessed this magical improvement in someone's eczema to the level shown in this study. Now, I'm not saying that the research is wrong or not to be trusted, but when someone asks me if L-histidine will fix their skin, the answer they get from me is likely not what they want to hear. Yes, there have been a small number of clients who have seen some possible improvement, as well as a small number of those in my skin rash rebuild group program. But most who try this don't notice anything. I've had a few listeners of the podcast write in to say that they believe that it's helped them. And if it has, I am so deeply happy for them. Now, why it's helped some, but not many, is incredibly unclear to me, and it's hard to know exactly who to recommend this to that would likely benefit from it most. It might be helpful along with other interventions that we have implemented for the client, but I can't say how helpful it is on its own. It's possible that there could be a synergistic effect. And so this is where testing out the research and working with it in practice can make a big difference. And it can help you know who might not tolerate a specific intervention very well. As in this case, some who have a really serious histamine overload problem often can't tolerate L-histidine because it's converted directly to histamine in your body. And when you use it clinically, you learn how to troubleshoot issues that may arise from certain types of case presentations. So that, again, explains why having the research coupled with a clinical experience is really, really helpful. Now, back in episode 290, I explained why what works for one person won't necessarily work for you and could even possibly make you feel worse. If you did miss that episode, definitely check it out. The feedback I got from listeners was really great and helped them to see why knowing your root causes is such a very important part of this entire process rather than just like doing what everyone else does and says works for them. And in this episode, I explained a bit about the importance of sample sizes when it comes to research. Basically, the number of people that the particular intervention was tested on. And another piece to this would also be if the research was conducted on the right population. So one more quick, very recent example is just today I was reading a neat study using a topical probiotic solution for reducing hyperpigmentation. So if your ears just perked up because you're struggling with hyperpigmentation, you might see this if you go Googling online. And the headline was what really caught my attention since so many people ask me about hyperpigmentation. And we do have a couple of episodes here on this topic, but the research was fascinating. So just from looking at the conclusion, it sounded like a winning solution. The researcher shared that, quote, the color intensity of the tanned skin was decreased by 47.64% and skin brightness was increased by 8.098% after the treatment period. The PMC48, which is the solution that they used, also significantly decreased the melanin index by 11.818%, while it improved skin moisture content level by 20.943%. It sounds good, right? The problem is that the study was only run on 22 participants, so our sample size is small. And when I dug deeper, I found that the participants were all healthy, having been subjected to artificially UV-induced tan skin, which was thus considered to be hyperpigmented. And in fact, the researchers explicitly excluded the following people: those without acute or chronic physical disease, including skin disease, pregnant or lactating women and women who were planning to become pregnant during the trial period, those who had a history of photoallergy or photosensitivity, those who had used external skin preparations containing steroids for more than 1 month for the treatment of skin diseases, and those who consumed a drug or food with a skin whitening effect, as well as those who were judged to be unsuitable for this study by the investigator, whatever that means. So if someone didn't read the details and just presented the conclusion, they might be led to believe that the topical probiotic combo in this particular case could be helpful for hyperpigmentation due to melasma or topical steroid use. But to be worth anything in my book, they need to do a larger study on those with actual hyperpigmentation concerns, like melasma or from topical steroid use, not just from having UV tanned skin. So for now, this is an idea, maybe a future possibility, but it could also be complete junk. We just don't know. I share this because I want you to make smarter, wiser, more measured decisions about what you try, as well as helping you to manage your expectations. Because research is shared all over the internet in ways that many times may not be appropriate. So for example, many blogs are littered with references that don't actually back up any of the claims the author was trying to make. This might be because the author doesn't know how to read research and drew inappropriate conclusions from it. I oftentimes see this when citations are from animal or test tube studies, which are red flags unless explicitly explained that their conclusions may or may not pan out inside the human body. Or the author might know that their audience doesn't know how to read research and that you don't actually ever even look at the citations that they list. And unfortunately, figure that you won't question the conclusions that they've drawn. And this, by the way, happens way more often than you realize on the internet. It also happens in the supplement and product industry as well. So if a company is offering references for their claims, it's worth seeing if the references are printed and available in your own language. So for example, if they use a study that's only available in Chinese and there's no way to translate it, and they know that they're marketing to, say, an American Western population that is majority English speaking and probably may not be able to read Chinese, that's a red flag. Number two, citing data specific to your condition that you're being marketed for. So are the benefits or claims that they're making derived from research that is done on other unrelated conditions? So for example, you might have rosacea, but the product and claims that they're making were done looking at cardiovascular disease or lung disease. Number three, is it an animal or test tube study? Sometimes test tube or petri dish is listed as in vitro study. These cannot exactly replicate what happens in the human body and should not be used in a one-to-one fashion. Number four, sharing outcomes from research with healthy individuals. We just saw that with that hypersensitivity paper that I was sharing with you where they actually looked at healthy individuals, but you want to look at studies and research that's done on your particular population. And then lastly, was the research conducted by anyone with a potential financial bias? Like, for example, being paid by the company that is using the research. It doesn't necessarily or automatically mean that they've done something nefarious, but it is worth noting this. And then we also see this in educational webinars, a ton with social media content. You should really verify the citations rather than just taking them at face value, because I've even seen some very notable functional practitioners who have posted content that goes viral, but the information was derived from animal research. And lastly, I think we even have to start asking this of presentations that are shown at conferences. I honestly wish the presenters would be required to disclose if they have any clinical experience with the data that they're presenting, especially if they're just sharing research on a topic. It would be helpful to know if they've actually tested it out. All of these interesting studies that they're sharing on actual people, their patients or their clients, to see if it's really worth caring about. And I realize that in many regards, you are left feeling like this adds an additional layer of complexity for you. But this is the complexity that I and my fellow practitioners are faced with when we look at research. And it explains why I have so much measured enthusiasm mixed with a healthy dose of skepticism. I talked a couple years ago on the podcast about managing your expectations along your healing journey, and this topic certainly goes hand in hand with that. So rather than getting overly excited, assuming that you found the next silver bullet, you can better manage the emotional ups and downs of this journey by going through the information with a measured approach so that you can ultimately make smarter choices along the way. Now, if you've got questions or thoughts about this, or you want to check out that hypersensitivity research or any of the other episodes that I've mentioned here, you can head on over to skinterrupt.com/300 so we can keep the conversation going. And if you know somebody who's an avid researcher and loves to dive into research, please feel free to share this episode with them. I'd love their two cents or their experience with trying to apply research to their particular case. And before you head off for your day, then take a moment to rate and review The Healthy Skin Show on your podcast platform and make sure to hit that subscribe button to stay in the loop on new research, clinical tips and strategies, personal stories, and inspiration that you need on your journey to rebuilding healthy skin. And then let's connect over on Instagram. I'm at Jennifer Fugo. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I look forward to digging deeper with you in the next episode.